Today, we begin at the beginning of Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel is thought to be the first written of the four Gospels in the Bible. It's also the shortest, and it tends to be the most direct. In John's Gospel, people are always talking about what things mean. In Matthew's Gospel, people are always talking about what Scripture is being fulfilled. Mark does some of that, but mostly Mark just gets down to business. Mark's gospel is action in motion. Things happen immediately in Mark, always immediately. There's always things happening. Mark's gospel famously doesn't have a real ending to it. It just ends with a preposition and a minute in the middle of a sentence. Through scribal transmission, three different endings would be added over time. Those are usually found at the end of most translations. But as far as we can tell, the actual ending in narrative and grammar is frayed. The beginning of the gospel is as well. Notice the first sentence of the book isn't even a complete sentence. There's no verb. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Furthermore, in the Greek, there's no definite article. It doesn't say the beginning, just beginning or a beginning. And so it reads something like this, beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And I think that's intended to be the title of the book, not the first sentence. The title isn't just referring to what happens in the opening scene. It's referring to the whole story. All of this book is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Which, of course, raises the question, if this is just the beginning, then what's next? And what's the end? And that's where our lives come in. We read ourselves into this story through the frayed edges on either end. It's our beginning. The life of Christian communities and of Christians is the continuation of the story that begins with the story of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And from the opening words, Mark assures us this is good news. And we need that assurance in no small part, because Mark immediately pushes us out into the wilderness. It seems that if we're going to hear this good news and receive the gospel, it will not be in the typical religious centers or civilized places. It's going to be in the margins, in the wilderness, on the unmapped places. We go out with crowds of people to hear the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The wilderness is where we respond to the gospel, or perhaps not at all. The first person we meet makes this perfectly clear. He's the one heralding this gospel message. His name is John. John is like an incarnation of wilderness. A wild man, wild hair. If the beginning and ends of Mark's gospel are grammatically frayed, John is the ragged embodiment of the preaching of this good news. John makes it clear that God is coming. God is here. We must prepare to receive God by repentance and commitment in all the frayed edges of our lives. What John is and who John is nothing compared to the one who's yet to come. I'm not worthy to stoop down and untie the laces on his sandals, John says. John looks like a prophet, sounds like a prophet, smells like a prophet. As a prophet in the wilderness, he represents a radical decentering of the good news of God. John's witness in the wilderness tells us something important about what's to come. Until now, God was supposed to be found in the ordered places, designated as places where you go to meet God. now something's changed. Something's been unleashed, and John can sense it. The gospel's not going to be found where you thought it was going to be found. It's not going to be civilized, commercialized, or compromised to the comforts of the contented. John's voice cries out in the wilderness, "Prepare the way of the Lord. Make his path straight." Pay attention to the grammar. Always in Mark, pay attention to the grammar. John is not just in the wilderness crying out, "Prepare the way of the Lord." John is crying out, "In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord." Do you hear the difference? The wilderness is not just the place from which God's good news happens to be proclaimed by a wild man. Wilderness is where the good news of God is coming. But what does that mean? We may have to read the rest of Mark to find out. When we do, then we realize it means more than dropping a pen on a map, because wilderness has more meaning than just geography. Geographically speaking, wilderness eludes precise definition, but it usually means the wide open spaces beyond human control. For the ancients, they even feared it was space beyond God's control. People get lost in the wilderness and they never come back. For human experience, the symbol of wilderness is any place where a person feels stripped of guidance, lost, and perplexed. You can be in a big old city and feel utterly lost in a wilderness. You can be a person of great resources and feel totally perplexed about what to do next in your life. You can be surrounded by people and feel utterly alone. Wilderness as a symbol describes the life location of whole groups of people who do not have abundant resources, who do not have access to expert guidance, and who truly can find no blazed trail out of the landscape of their suffering. Stephen Bain was thinking of wilderness in just this way, the human experience. Bain was appointed the first executive officer of the Worldwide Anglican Communion in 1959. He had a big, overwhelming job. It was so big, he is said to have remarked, "I am rather like a mosquito in a nudist camp. I know what I ought to do, but I have no idea where to begin." Which is just even better if you think about that in a British accent. Try it. Faced with a whole world suffering in need of the church's witness and embodiment of the good news of Jesus Christ, Bain's moral compass pointed true north. He wrote, "The church has no mission of its own. All we can have by ourselves is a club or a debating society. And our only hope left to ourselves is to win as many members for our own club and away from other clubs as we can. And whatever this is, it is not mission. Mission belongs to God. It was his from the beginning. It is his. It will always be his. He has his purposes from the foundation of the world and the means to fulfill them. And the only part the church has in this is obedience, a share in the eternal and life-giving obedience of the Son of God. And the most terrible judgment on the church comes when God leaves us to our own devices because he is tired of waiting for our obedience, leaves us to be domestic chaplains to a secular and comfortable world, and goes himself into the wilderness of human need and injustice and pain." This judgment does come on churches and nations when they forget that God is in command, that God does the choosing. God chooses wilderness. The Jews knew about wilderness of human need and injustice and pain. They knew about the geography of wilderness, bordered as they were by an ocean of water and an ocean of sand, and they knew all too well about the wilderness experience of life. In the wilderness, if you're still long enough, you hear a cry. Perhaps, as Leonardo Boff put it, the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor. To cry has a double meaning. It means to cry out, like proclaim something boldly and loudly, like a preacher in the wild, John, like Isaiah before him, cries out for all who will listen. God is coming. God is here. You are not alone. You are not forsaken. To cry also means to weep. There is weeping in the wilderness of life. For those lost in the wild, it is a scary, lonely place to be. A few days ago, I went for a run in Cameron Park, which I do from time to time. It took me many runs and walks years ago to begin to navigate the twisted, intersecting, confusing paths through the hills and brush of the park. I still get turned around regularly. It's not uncommon to come on someone who's totally disoriented in the park, even as small as it is there in the city of Waco. So last week when I was running, I heard a scream. Not like someone was hurt kind of scream, but like someone was trying to get attention from anyone who would listen. It happened that the trail that I was on took me closer to the source of the sound. And as I approached, I came upon a teenager who, upon seeing me, tried to play it cool. I asked him, "Is everything all right?" He said, "Yes." He paused. He said, "I've lost my brother." "What does he look like?" I asked. He told me. I said, "If I find him, I'll send him this way." "Okay," he said. It was cold. It was starting to get dark. I headed on down the trail. And fortunately, not terribly far away, I came upon a boy who fit the description. He was totally disoriented about where he was and where he was supposed to go. I said, "Are you looking for your brother?" He said, "Yes." I said, "He's that way." "Okay, thanks," he said. And he took off running like a deer bounding through the woods. There's very little feeling compared to being lost and then being found. Wilderness is a scary place to be. Lose your job, lose your spouse, lose your scholarship, lose your mind. You lose the map you used to navigate the next steps in life. What now? Don't let the trappings of modern life fool you to what's just underneath. Beneath the comforts of modern life, there lies a wilderness of human suffering, crying out for some relief, for truth, for grace, for love, for meaning in life. In the memory of the Exodus from Egypt, wilderness was a place of a long journey of testing and learning to trust in God when there were no other options. It was hard, but at least it wasn't slavery. Wilderness wasn't just an empty place on the map of the world. Wilderness was a feeling of being lost, being alone, being perplexed, and maybe there meeting God. Now, some modern people have romanticized this feeling, recognizing that our civilized, commodified, capitalized culture deadens something in them that they yearn to stir to new life. Thoreau, for example, at Walden Pond writes, "In the wilderness lies the preservation of the world. Only when we are lost can we begin to find ourselves." A century later, Wallace Stegner writes, advocating for the preservation of wild places, "What I want to speak for is not so much the wilderness uses, valuable as those are, but the wilderness idea, which is a resource in itself. Being an intangible and spiritual resource, it will seem mystical to the practical-minded. But then again, anything that cannot be moved by a bulldozer is likely to seem mystical to them." Stegner calls wilderness a geography of hope. Wilderness as a geography of hope may seem like an overcooked image until you consider the Black church experience. Theologian Dolores Williams offers a version of wilderness, the wilderness idea, rooted in the experience of enslaved persons. Rather than a place to be feared, wilderness is seen in the biblical Hagar and the Exodus experience as a place of struggle and spirit, both problematic and promising. For African American slaves, writes Williams, the wilderness did not bear the negative connotations that mainline white pioneer culture assigned to it. The wilderness was a positive place, conducive to uplifting the spirit and to strengthening faith. The symbolic wilderness, then, isn't just a forlorn place of suffering. In this wilderness, we hear the sounds of those who courageously navigated dangerous terrain, took each step with radical faith, cultivated through God's timely, miraculous provision through their long journey. No wonder why all the people of Jerusalem went to meet John in the wilderness. Something deep in them stirred when they realized God was at it again. They were drawn to a man on the margins with a message that it is in the wilderness of our lives where God's good news begins. Proclaimed on the frontier of the inhabitable world, preached to people ready to hear good news anywhere they could find it, the gospel is good news of comfort. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term. Her penalty is paid. She is saved. Earlier this fall, a 38-year-old mother, laid off from her work because of the pandemic, drove to Zion National Park to hike all alone. Her story has all kinds of frayed edges to it. Already plagued with mental health challenges for years, now saddled with the grief and the fear that comes from losing your job, your livelihood, she told her daughter she just needed to get away on a spiritual retreat. "I have to go," she said. So she went to Zion, where she could get lost in the canyons and the wilderness of that fierce landscape. Shortly into her journey, she fell, and she hit her head on a tree. And now she was in real trouble. No one knew where she was. Alone in the wild, unable to take two steps without collapsing, her only source of water, a river discovered recently to be poisoned from pollution. She was in the fight of her life. 2 days later, she was reported missing, and a massive hunt was on. People who loved her and people who didn't know her but loved people went out looking for her like hundreds of shepherds looking for one lost sheep. 2 weeks later, on the verge of death, she was found. Or, really, if we're really telling as much of the story as we know, her journey to being saved was just begun, as she begins to get all the help she needs. The gospel comes to shadowlands and into the margins and into the places where people are lost and hurting and alone and dying. The gospel comes to the places where doubt meets fears and into the frayed edges of our lives. That, my friends, is good news. If it were not so, we would have to live in fear that the gospel may not be worthy of our cries. But now we know from the beginning, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, begins on the margins. A voice of hope crying out from and into the wilderness of our lives. The gospel begins in the wilderness, and it belongs there.